Dr. DeBakey, thank you very much for taking the time to share your wisdom and understanding experience with us. I'd like to begin going back into the 1930s when you chose to go to Germany for surgical training. How did that come about and why did you choose to go to Germany?
Well, there was a professor in Heidelberg that my professor recommended I work with. He had done the first successful pulmonary embolectomy not long before that. And he was a great teacher of surgery. I didn't find that out until I got there. Very precise, very disciplined. And he had a good research lab of animals. So I got some research training there. That's how I came about.
What was the quality of medical training in Germany at that time?
I must say I was not aware during my period of training there of the Nazi influence. I had a small circle of friends, students, that we would occasionally go out and have a beer. But other than that, I was, you know, pretty busy with my work. And I was not, say, attuned to political developments. I didn't have any interest in it. So I didn't know what was going on. I just knew there was a general policy that they had developed against Jews, because I heard that. But that's all I knew.
Did it affect anything going on in the hospital?
No.
Nothing that you could see?
No, although on one occasion, my closest friend, a colleague who was a German, I remember telling me about a friend of his who had been a young instructor in the department, who was Jewish and who left the country. And he told me that he was sorry to have him leave because he was a good friend of his and they liked each other and he missed him. But he said he's probably happier because he was unhappy here. And that was about the way I got it.
Do you know what happened to your mentors as the Nazis turned?
There was only one faculty member that I remember hearing about had deported for Switzerland, had transferred, who was Jewish. And I got the impression from the way he talked that he was leaving the country because of his Jewish factor. But you see, I wasn't, somehow or another, I just wasn't enough interested to learn more about this. You know, I thought maybe there was prejudice, but other than that, it never occurred to me this was a policy. That was the worst part I found out later.
How would you compare the quality of surgical training in Germany at that time?
It was very good.
Compared to, say, the United States?
Very good. See, I'd had a year in Strasbourg before. Mm-hmm. Went to Heidelberg. And the quality in Heidelberg was much more disciplined.
And how did it compare to what was going on in the United States? What was the quality of surgical
far
training?
Far superior. Nothing like it in the United States. You got to remember that we're talking about 1930s and 40s. And surgery, in fact, medical care in America was pretty low. And there were spots of good surgery, like the Mayo Clinic, University of Pennsylvania, a few places like that. But that's all. It was mostly pretty mediocre.
Did many of your
that's why I went. I wanted to get good training in research. I was looking forward to a career in surgery, in research, in a medical institution. You see, and I wanted to prepare myself the best I could.
Did many of your colleagues or associates or people at your age at the time go to Germany for training? Was that
if they could afford it.
If they could afford it.
They were damn few scholarships.
How did the Germans?
I was lucky. My parents could afford it.
And how did the Germans receive American people?
Oh, very good. There was a very nice quality among your close colleagues, students, you know. I'd go out with them, they treated me like one of them. We'd go out and have beer together and things like that.
What language did you use?
German, yeah.
Did you know German before you went over?
No, I didn't know it very well. You know, I had it in high school. But I took a course very quickly. And by the time I left, I was doing pretty well.
What's your most striking memories of that time in Germany? In the hospital or outside the hospital? What do you remember most about the entire experience?
One of the nice things I remember was they, like everybody else in the world, at that time there were no blood banks. Giving a blood transfusion was quite an affair. And I had developed a little transfusion instrument, a roller pump. And I could give a transfusion in 5 minutes. See, I took one with me, and I got to be a transfusion expert for the whole country. And they used to all come around and see me do one, you know.
You must have become quite a celebrity in the medical service.
Yeah, oh yes. In fact, I got their admiration right quick, because they weren't doing it.
How did they actually do with that new pump that you do? How was it actually done technically? What did you actually do at that time?
Well, you had to have the donors and the patient side by side, because the blood was transferred from the donor to the patient.
Directly.
So I put a needle in the donor, a needle in the patient, connected to my roller pump, and I was on my way. 5 minutes is over.
So it wasn't even machine driven, it was hand cranked?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, hand cranked. Yeah. It was very nice. I did the same thing in Strasbourg, too. By the time I got to Heidelberg, they'd heard about it. So they wanted me to get transfused as soon as I got there.
Any other experiences you recall fondly or not so fondly that you'd like to share with us?
Well, they would call on me to do this in that private hospital. So I would, you know, go there, give a transfusion to a private patient. It was always interesting to see that being done. The private hospitals were where the professor of surgery did his work and where he made his money.
What sort of patients were getting transfusions back? Were it surgical patients that were bleeding?
Yes. Well, most of them were surgical. Yeah. Bleeding ulcers, things like that.
And how had they done it before you brought the pump over to?
Well, they made an effort to do it with multiple syringes, which, you know, by the time I got to the fourth or fifth syringe, they already had clotting. It was always quite a mostly unsuccessful procedure.
After you left Germany, you wound up serving in the American military. What was that like for you? All of a sudden you were at war with a country that trained you.
Yeah, well, that's true, but, you know, when I got back, I went into full-time Department of Surgery at Tulane. And I guess, let's see, I must have come and got back about 40, 41, 42, something like that. I was altogether about 8 years or more at Tulane before I went into service. I think I went into service with 42. Because I applied as soon as I could after the war began. And I hadn't got my assignment after I applied. So all of a sudden I got a call from Rankin, Dr. Rankin, who had taken a position in the military service. So, Colonel, to head up the division of surgical consultant division in the Surgeon General's office. He knew me through Dr. Oxford, I was a good friend of his. And when he learned that I had applied, he immediately got me transferred to his office. So I spent a year in his office, 5 years.
So the 5 years, I recalled you had told me you had actually gone to Europe and traveled with Patton during the war.
Oh, yes,
well,
I traveled with all the armies. My first assignment was the 5th Army when they were in Africa. I came up with them through Italy. And that's where I learned the facts about the treatment of the wounded actually happening. And it was awful. You know, I was just absolutely astounded. People were dying because of lack of knowledge how to treat them, you know?
Who was treating them at their...
They were general practitioners and brought into the service. And they weren't surgeons at all, you know? You're a doctor, so they put you in this slot. So I came back and wrote a big report to the Surgeon General, and I tested the idea with Pete Churchill, who was the surgical consultant for the 5th Army. And he thought it was a great idea. My idea was to get these well-trained physicians at the MGH Military Hospital, on the surgical faculty. They were assistant associate professors who had been trained at the MGH. And they were well-trained surgeons. And make a team with one of them. So you had an assistant, surgical nurse, circular nurse, technicians, anesthesiologists, you know, 7 or 8 people. We had a team, surgical team. And you moved them where you needed them. So when the wounded were admitted in quite a few in large numbers to a field of evacuation hospital, which was our most forward hospital, we just moved them up there to take care of the patients. And when they got through, they didn't have anything to do, they could move back, you see? And we called them mobile surgical units. The term MASH came later in Korea, where they combined the idea and where the terrain was such that they didn't need to move the hospitals. You know, they put an evacuation hospital not too far from the front lines. It stayed there. You see, we moved ours. And so the personnel was full-time in that hospital. So they call it the Mobile Surgical Hospital. That's where MASH came in, Mobile Army Surgical Hospital.
How was your idea initially received when you proposed it?
Initially, there was objection to it. There's always objections to anything new. But by the time it was over, they were very, very enthusiastic about it.
Did you participate in one of the surgical teams to try it out?
Mm-hmm. Oh, yes.
How'd it work?
Worked fine. Worked fine. I was busy as hell. I liked it. Yeah.
Did that experience help you later on in life?
Not very much. No, I'd had a lot of training and trauma before I went in. And in New Orleans. But it lowered the mortality for the Army wounded to the lowest in all of military history. We got down to 4%. That was pretty good.
You mentioned before in traveling with Patton, you started hearing some news about doctors and other people behaving badly in concentration camps and elsewhere.
Well, we heard indirectly they had these concentration camps. At first, I didn't connect it with the Jewish. That came a little later when we got into Germany and our armies overran them and found them. And the first I heard, I was in Washington, in my office, in St. John's office, and we got word, I think it was the Seventh Army, but I'm a little hazy about it now, had found this prison, all Jewish people in there, youngsters, kids, women, older men, and they were being prepared for death sentence. And we were absolutely horrified when we heard about this. We said, you know, this is not a savage country. This is a civilized country. What are they doing? What's happening? Couldn't believe it. Just couldn't believe it. But we had the facts, and it was true. I still have difficulty believing it. It's so horrendous.
Especially the country where you were in part trained.
Well, not only that, but you know, I lived with these people. They weren't savages. They were nice folks. What the hell happened to them? You know? That's what horrified me. You know, I thought, my God, if this could happen to them, it could happen to us. You know? That's just unbelievable. Incredulous. I don't care who you are, what your religion is, what the hell difference does it make? If you're in a community, you behave like you're a member of the community, that's all. Your religion is your personal belief. You have a right to that, you know. I know a little bit about religion because I made an effort to learn. In my personal library, I would say at least 2,500 books on religion, different religions of the world. So I know the background, the history for most religions. The only religion I know that justifies murder is the Muslim religion. It's the only one. And I've read them all, so I know the background of all of them. In the Quran, which is their Bible, there is a specific stanza that deals with this. And it relates to a Muslim doing murder on behalf of the Muslim religion or on behalf of a Muslim principle. And you go directly to heaven. Imagine that. That's the only one. All the other religions are generally peaceful, you know. Some more than others. I would say the Christian religion is one of the most peaceful. And the Jewish too. Although there is a more militant aspect of the Jewish religion than is present in the Christian religion, largely because as a Jew, Jesus Christ described his views, you see, about peace. He was a strong person for peace. He'd rather be hurt than strike back, turn the other cheek. You see, no other religion does that, but most of them don't do the opposite either, you see. The difference, I think, lies in the history of the Jewish people, who had to protect themselves, and who were led by leaders who were willing to fight to protect themselves. Whereas most of the disciples of Christ weren't willing to fight, you see. That's the only difference. Because you see, almost all the principles of the Christian religions are derived from habitat and the, you might say, culture of the Jewish religion, which is a good religion. You see, religion is supposed to give you comfort because it answers a question you can't answer any other way except by believing. And you can't answer with evidence, you see. You've got to believe. So it's either you believe or you don't believe. That's religion. You see? I believe because I began believing when I was a little small child. And it's a comfort to me to believe. In other words, I'm more comfortable believing than I would be not believing. So I don't argue. You see? You don't argue when you believe. You don't have to.
When the facts of what was going on in Europe came to light, was there awareness of the role of the doctors in those events, or was that not known at the time?
Yes, there was awareness. That made it all the more horrendous that there were sub-doctors involved in it. That was nothing. I just couldn't believe it.
What was your own experience in dealing with other doctors in wartime? Did they behave honorably as a group?
Well, you got to remember, you have, during wartime, a certain, I might say, modification of the culture and habits of the country to adapt to the wartime principles. So even though you might be a very peaceful person, in wartime you develop a little militant character. But at no time does that militant aspect of it drives you to savagery, you see? And this attitude of German policy by highest authorities against Jews is pure savagery. There's no basis for it, you see? The Jews were contributing, not draining from the community. Some of the scientific leaders were the top scientists, you know. Some of the bankers were the top bankers in Germany's time. See, a few of them escaped because they were that high. And they were able to get enough, you might say, influence to allow them to go to Switzerland and so on. But otherwise, this was pure savagery.
From doctors who had sworn
everybody. I don't think it'll ever happen again. The reason I say that is because it's so horrendous that you have to have a combination of a crazy person leading a lot of passive people, you see? And that combination is rare.
When you trained in Germany, at that time, Germany was very high quality medicine, perhaps the highest.
Oh, yes.
Now we are 67 years later, and America has that position in the world. How did that come about?
I've thought about that a great deal. And I like to think I'm right about this. In the early 50s, I began to be aware, because I lived in Washington 5 years, so I learned a lot about Washington and the government. One of the leaders in Congress at that time was a senator named Hill, Lester Hill. His father was a surgeon in Alabama, and he was greatly impressed with Lister. So he named his son Lester. And I got to know him, and I testified before his committee, and he took a liking to me. So he'd call me from time to time about a bill he was working on. And finally, it seemed to me he had an interest in research, medical research. And I thought, this is wonderful. So I sort of encouraged him. I said, you know, so we need to expand our research ability. We don't have any research. There was no NIH at that time at all. He understood that. And he started putting money into research. He started to build the NIH. And I worked with him on it. And I like to think that that was the beginning of the elevation of standards in medicine, you see? Because we now have the greatest research medical endeavor in the world, you know? And it started there.
What are the key developments you think are important in making America's position in the biomedical world so prominent? What other things happened in the last 60 years in your mind that you've seen?
Well, you've got to remember that to a large extent, cardiovascular surgery was developed when I was a youngster in medicine in training. There was a thing conceptually called thoracic surgery, but it dealt mostly with lungs. There was virtually no cardiovascular at all. There was no treatment for aneurysm, things like that. We did the first, and in a way, some of my first successful cardiovascular cases became the basis for ushering in the specialty of cardiovascular surgery. In the Baker Library Museum, they are developing panels about my first successful case, and about 15 panels of different types of cardiovascular cases that I did first, that was first successful. And the fact that it was successful was the impressive thing. You don't get any credit for it if it's not successful. And some of them had a great impact. For example, when I did the first carotid artery, I wrote it up as a case report in JAMA. Within a few years, it became a very popular operation. Thousands of cases were being done every day. So much so that the neurologists and neurosurgeons got involved because they thought maybe too many being done. So they organized a committee, and finally became the International Committee, to address the problem of stroke. And over several years, they did a hell of a good job. And finally, they laid down the principles of management of stroke for the first time. So you see, case report did that impact. The fact that the disease was common and had been on no effective treatment for it, the procedure of coronary bypass became very popular when I reported the first successful case. That's interesting because that is a good example. At Johns Hopkins, a young surgeon did a coronary bypass 2 years before we did ours. But he lost his patient 2 or 3 days afterwards from a stroke. So nobody paid attention. It wasn't successful. I was lucky, mine was successful. Everybody paid attention.
Do you remember the details of that first case? Do you remember the details of the first?
Oh, yes, I remember every detail. I did it. Because I hadn't been working nearly 3 years in the laboratory doing coronary bypass in animals. And the last report I made was about 2 or 3 months before I did this case, in which I said that we are successful in about 50% of the cases. and we had to do a little better. And the patient I had became an emergency on the table because I was trying to do an endarterectomy and it destroyed the right, I mean the left, main left coronary artery. So either I did something radical or he was going to die on the table. Unfortunately, I knew what to do because I've been operating an animal. So I did the bypass. And it worked.
How was that new procedure? Mm-hmm. How was that new procedure received?
Oh, very enthusiastically. Well, in most cases. There was some resistance from a few people, but not top cardiologists.
While America was developing this research base, what was going on in the rest of the world in terms of biomedical research?
Not too much. I would say, if you look at the people who won the Nobel Prize, you have to say most of them came out of Europe. Today, 70% of them are Americans. You see what a change that is. They were distributed in Europe all over. Germany, France, Italy, England, so on. Occasional for America, only occasional. You know, until I would say the last 25 years, more and more Americans.
One of the biggest developments has been the Human Genome Project.
Well, that's an American project. That's pure American.
What impact do you think that'll have on the practice of medicine?
Well, it's too hard to say right now. I think it's going to have an impact. But you can't say how much or what kind of impact it'll have. If they develop the genome to the point where they can do a very simple test. Any genome practitioner can do it in his office to identify certain, diseases that are definitely genetic in origin. When they do that, then you see that you've made a tremendous gain in knowledge. You'll be able to deal with disease a little better, a little more effectively.
Do you have any concern that might be used as a discriminatory tool in any way?
Oh, yes, that's always possible. But, you know, if you look at the history of things that give concern like that, you'll see that as time went on, those concerns were pretty well met in time. And so he didn't have, I would say, too great a problem to deal with.
Some people have raised the concern that if Germany, which was the leading country in biomedical research and practice of medicine 100 years ago, could do what it, that America potentially could have the same problems. Do you have any concerns or fears about that?
None whatsoever. No, I don't.
What protects America from that sort of stuff?
Well, reasonableness. You know, you got to be reasonable. And most people are. Majority of your friends are reasonable, you know? And it doesn't matter what religion they are. Yeah, so absurd. In fact, I would rather have a friend who is religious than one who's not, you know? Because I have a greater trust in a person who believes, you see? Because I think it's more reasonable to believe than not to believe. And so this, to me, that's a reasonable person.
Recently,
I don't care what religion he has.
Recently, when you received your medal from President Bush, you mentioned the VA as an exemplary system of medicine.
Well, I mentioned the VA because, you see, I've been associated with Medicare since its beginning, since Kennedy started it. I thought it was a great idea. I had a lot of patients who were older, retired, who had needed surgery for cardiovascular disease, and they didn't have any money, you see. So I thought this was a great idea, and I was strongly for it. as time has gone on, the wolves in, and you might say, medical enterprises got hold of it. I wrote an article about 3 or 4 years ago, just before I got ill with this section, in which I documented what they do. I was so shocked, you know, by having read some of it, that I made an effort to learn as much as I could about what they were doing. They were making contracts with Medicare where they made all the money. Damn little of it was going to care of patients. There was a fellow head of one of these health maintenance organizations in New York, just retired, at $1 billion. You know? Where the hell did he get that? I found out that they often, at the end of the year, have bonuses of $100 million. That's where the money's going. And the VA medical system also I've been associated with since it began, because I was on the committee with Hawley and Bradley in 1950. And fortunately, we did a good job in organizing it. We organized it as a full-time system. We gave a little encouragement to doctors to get their boards by giving them 25% increase in salary. We made an affiliation with medical schools and the VA hospital and so on, you see. Now, right now, they give on the average, in general, a superior quality of medical care than any other agency, private or government. And they do so at half the cost. Think of that.
What's the secret?
The secret is the fact that they take their money and they use it for just what they need. They don't contract with a health maintenance organization to do it. So a health maintenance organization can't get the whole of that money. You see, the majority of the funds that Medicare contracts for goes into the pockets and coffers of these health and maintenance organizations, insurance companies.
What are your hopes for the future of the Texas Medical Center, for the future of medicine? What would you like to see happen?
Well, I'd like to see them continue put emphasis upon research and clinical investigation, and have a faculty that is, you might be research minded. Without research, you don't get new knowledge. You may not get it with research, but you can be absolutely certain that without research, you get nothing.
Are there any special areas of emphasis for research?
Well, you go to where areas of need. I mean, unfortunately, medicine is full of areas of need, as you know.
You mentioned your own surgery. How do you look back upon that entire experience now?
Well, I look back with some pleasure and some pride. I never accomplished all the things I wanted to accomplish, but I accomplished some. I did a number of firsts, and I helped to usher in the development of cardiovascular surgery as a specialty and make it a field of interest, a usefulness. Take myself. I was hit with a fatal disease. I actually described and did and performed the operation that was done on me. You see? So George Noon did exactly what I described.
How do you view that entire experience of your surgery and the whole all the tumult around that, and how do you look back on it now?
Well, with some pride, but not too much. So we will. You got to have a sense of humor.
What would you like to accomplish next?
Well, you might say the goal I set for myself earlier was to find the cause of osteosclerosis. I didn't. I failed to do that. I learned a lot about it that they didn't, and other people didn't know, but I don't know the cause. It may well be genetic, but that hasn't been determined either. So there's still a lot to learn in that field. But you know, I accomplished quite a bit, if you think about it. I operated on more than 60,000 patients in the cardiovascular field. That's a lot.
If a young man was approaching you about whether he should go into the field of medicine, or he was already in the field of medicine, what advice would you offer him?
Well, I'd say if you want to go into the field, prepare yourself, because to be successful, you're going to have to give up some things. You can't go to the movies regularly. You can't be taking vacations often. You're going to have to work at what you're doing, you see? And that means sacrificing these other things. But willingly, you got to be, you know, it never bothered me to sacrifice a dinner at all. Because I enjoyed what I was doing more, you know.
How did you manage to sleep during all this time?
Well, you know, I used to travel a great deal. And I'd sleep on a plane. I'd get on a plane and sometimes I'd sound asleep before it took off. Yeah.
What do you see as the future of cardiovascular surgery with all new techniques coming in and devices?
I think it's reasonably hardy. Reasonably be healthy. I was talking to a fellow from Rostock, Germany yesterday who came to give a lecture here on dissection, aortic dissection. And he's a pretty good example of some new people in the field. You know, he's trying out new concepts and new ideas in surgery for dissection. Just like I was. So I think it's, and you know, these endovascular procedures, I think they're doing a pretty good job.
We appreciate it, Dr. DeBakey. Any final words you want to offer? Or questions you want to ask?
Well, you know, if I was Jewish, I would be a little concerned about the history of this savagery that occurred in Germany. But I would take some solace in the fact that we have probably passed that stage, and it'll probably never happen again, because to have that combination is unusual, very unusual. So I don't think you're going to ever get a whole society to just suddenly become savage, you see? Suddenly go crazy. I just don't think that's possible anymore. So that would give me some solace, because I would hate to think that this age-old prejudice is not being finally put to bed somewhere. In medicine, I know it has. You know, we have some of the finest people in medicine are Jewish. And I admire them tremendously because they worked with me closely. And I take pride in the fact that sometimes I didn't know they were Jewish. till much, much later, because I don't look to see what religion you belong to. That doesn't bother me at all. In fact, as I said before, I prefer to be associated with sort of religious people. Not outright, but privately religious. I have tremendous admiration for the Jewish people and their history. And in any society in which they have been prominent, they've added to the society. You know, they've added. So why do you, to me, you have to admire that. Not be sorry for it. I admire that.
You raise a point I thought about when you were speaking. When the Germans started their policies, their medical policies, they often referred to what was going on in the United States, where we were sterilizing people involuntarily in 28 states, and they referred to the Jim Crow laws in the southern states. And they used that as justification. They made some pretty powerful arguments, even in their own defense, at the doctor's trial in Nuremberg.
But I don't think it had anything to do with the development of that policy. This was an internal policy development by a crazy man, like all the other things he did. When you look at what he did, to show you how crazy he was, when he got to Paris, he could have stopped. And he would have been sitting at the top, as far as his country is concerned, his people. And he would not have, gone to war with the United States. That was the biggest mistake he made. He should have known about it. I'll just give you an example. I was in Patton's army, and we were moving forward with the tanks. And in order for him to keep up, he had to bring gas for his tanks by air. So the engineers would lay down a chain type of airports, you know, for the DC-3s to park it. Every minute I saw them, a DC-3 would come down, land, and give up a gas in here. Every 3 minutes. They couldn't do that. The Germans couldn't do that. You see, they couldn't possibly beat us because we could outproduce them. We could produce more in 1 or 2 days than they could produce in a month. See, that's what beat them. We had more planes, we had more bombs, we had more of everything. You know, it took us 2 or 3 years to get ready. But once we were up to the task, we were producing more automobiles, more Jeeps, more DC-3s. We overwhelmed them, you see? And you'd think a man, as head of a great country like Germany, would have advisors to tell him, don't do that. You're suicide to get to the United States. He did it anyway. So you see, crazy.
And we had better care for our wounded soldiers in the field, thanks to you.
Well, that was a little bit of luck in a way, because I happened to be in the right place at the right time, right at the beginning of the war, and I picked it up quickly. And fortunately, made a good analysis of the problem. Again, it shows, you know, that trained personnel is no substitute for that. No.
Well, thank you again, Dr. DeBakey. It's been
welcome.
A pleasure
thank
speaking
you.
With you.
Nice to talk to you.